Russian inspectors were in Montana recently visiting dismantled nuclear launch sites. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you why Congressman Steve Daines was on the University of Montana campus today. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with prominent atheist Ronald Lindsay about maintaining the separation of church and state. Air Force officials say Russian inspectors visited Montana this month to verify that 18 nuclear missile launch facilities have been demolished as part of a 2011 arms control treaty. Malmstrom Air Force Base officials said today the inspectors spent 12 hours on April 9th viewing the facilities in central Montana to see the doors had been removed and the launcher tubes filled with earth and gravel. Treaty Compliance Chief Richard Bialchek of the 341st Missile Wing says the inspection was the first of its kind at Malmstrom. The demolished facilities were operated by the 564th Missile Squadron, which was deactivated in 2008. Three other missile squadrons are responsible for the 150 intercontinental ballistic missiles at Malmstrom. Air Force officials say all 50 of the 564th Squadron's launch facilities will be demolished.
And in other news from around the state, a Montana man died after a small sailboat capsized yesterday near Port Townsend. Police say 57-year-old Stephen I. Halpin of Huson was sailing with his wife and another woman in gathering of dinghies known as scamp boats when their vessel overturned. Another sailor picked up the three from the water and they were on their way back to shore when Halpin went into cardiac arrest. East Jefferson Fire Rescue Deputy Chief Gordon Pomeroy told the Peninsula Daily News a rescue team responded, but it was requested to stop CPR because Halpin had a terminal medical condition and a do not resuscitate order. On Saturday, the Coast Guard responded to a separate capsized sailboat in the same area, and no one was injured.
Kelly Knievel is asking the Attorney General's Office to investigate the nonprofit group that has staged the Evel Knievel Days Festival in Butte. The son of the late daredevil told the Montana Standard he mailed a complaint to Attorney General Tim Fox, saying he believes Evel Knievel Week Incorporated didn't follow its bylaws. He also was seeking information about the group's finances over the past 3 years. Fox's Deputy Communications Director Anastasia Burton said today that the office generally requires a specific complaint of wrongdoing, along with some credible evidence of the violations, in order to start an investigation. Members of Evel Knievel Week, Inc. recently cut ties with the festival in the fallout of a struggle over management and control of the three-day event. A new group has been created to stage this year's festival.
A man has pleaded guilty to helping a former state legislator embezzle federal money meant for the Chippewa Cree tribe. James Howard Eastlick appeared in U.S. District Court in Great Falls today to plead guilty to aiding and abetting theft from an Indian tribal government receiving federal funding. The charge carries a maximum penalty of 10 years in prison and $250,000 fine. U.S. District Judge Brian Moore set sentencing for August 15th. Prosecutors say Eastlick, his daughter, and her husband kicked back hundreds of thousands of dollars to Chippewa Cree Construction Corporation CEO Tony Belcourt. Belcourt, a former lawmaker, awarded Eastlick's family contracts for a Rocky Boys Reservation water pipeline project. Belcourt has pleaded guilty to theft, bribery, and tax evasion. Four other defendants have pleaded not guilty.
Representative Steve Daines was briefed today on some award-winning brain injury research underway at the University of Montana Mountain Campus in Missoula. UM Research Assistant Professors Sarge Patel and Tom Rao conduct research at UM's Department of Biomedical and Pharmaceuticals in the Skaggs School of Pharmacy. They're studying blood-based biomarkers that indicate how the brain reacts following a traumatic brain injury, or TBI. This issue is generating intense interest among athletes and the military as researchers work to determine the long-term impacts of and best treatments for brain injuries. Patel says Montana has among the highest number of brain injury cases in the nation.
Lots of accidents, you know, working in the fields, working in farming. We have a pretty extensive outdoor life here in the state, and, you know, people get out and get into trouble sometimes on the ski hills or run into trees and things like that. But you know, we do have a large veteran population here in the state too. And so when they return, you know, a lot of them have been injured in active service and come back with TBIs.
Steve Daines, Montana's Republican representative, who earned his Bachelor of Science degree in chemical engineering, listened to the nearly hour-long presentation and peppered Rao and Patel with several questions during the process. Afterwards, he described the research as interesting and exciting.
It really piques my interest, but it's exciting to see how we can take the science used to help our veterans here who have suffered traumatic brain injuries, and it's happening right here at the University of Montana, one of the leaders in the country in this research. And so it's really great to see how we can connect the dots here to help our veterans who are suffering from these traumatic brain injuries.
Patel and Rao were awarded a $300,000 grant earlier this year by the NFL and GE, who will provide mentorship and access to the GE researchers and other industry leaders as the two compete with 15 other winners for an additional $500,000 reward in the next stage of the $20 million Head Health Challenge.
The first group of absentee ballots for Montana's 2014 primary election are in the mail. Secretary of State Linda McCullough said today that county election offices have mailed ballots to the state's absent military and overseas citizens who have requested absentee ballots. Ballots for others who want to vote absentee in the primary will be mailed on May 5th, the last day for regular voter registration. Late registration for the primary runs from May 6th through 8 p.m. on June 3rd, the day of the primary election. McCullough says 61% of the ballots cast in the 2012 primary were absentee ballots.
The Montana Land Board has approved the purchase of 320 acres of threatened grizzly bear habitat next to the Blackleaf Wildlife Management Area. The state is buying the land from the Conservation Fund for $345,000 with a grant from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services to help the recovery of grizzlies in the Northern Continental Divide. The 320 acres is considered critical grizzly bear habitat and is adjacent to the 10,397-acre wildlife management area in Teton County. Candace Duran of the Department of Natural Resources and Conservation says the Conservation Fund paid $575,000 for the land. The fund is selling it at a discount, and the difference will be counted as a matching contribution for the grant. The Land Board approved the purchase today.
Is America too religious or not religious enough? Does our government truly separate church and state? The D.C. and New York-based Center for Inquiry would answer yes to the first question and no to the second. The center lobbies and litigates for separation of church and state and advocates for what it calls scientific naturalism. President and CEO Ronald Lindsay is in Montana this week to talk about his new book titled The Necessity of Secularism. In this feature interview, Lindsay talks with news director Sally Mock about his atheism and his advocacy of a science-based belief system.
Scientific naturalism is a worldview that looks to science and empirical evidence to shape our beliefs. We believe our beliefs should conform to the evidence that's accessible to everyone, and that's the evidence that is discovered by science. In other words, it essentially says we should not allow supernatural beliefs to affect our views of things. So it's a naturalistic world outlook. But our mission actually is broader than that. Our mission is to foster a secular society based on reason, science, freedom of inquiry, and humanist values.
Your group, though, also says, quote, "In aiming to foster a secular society, we do not seek to abridge the rights of believers."
That's correct. We affirm it. I mean, when we say humanist values, one of those values is respect for the fundamental rights of all human beings. Sometimes I'm asked, was it like a summary of humanist values? If you look at the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, that's probably a good approximation of it. We firmly believe in the importance of freedom of conscience for everyone. Everyone should be allowed to form their beliefs about whether there's a God or not, or gods or not, without any pressure or coercion from any government or any individual.
The practice of that belief is where the clash comes, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. It comes in a number of ways. Sometimes it comes because the government of the particular nation in which people are located may lend support to one belief or another. That usually leads, of course, to resentment, sometimes violence, sometimes suppression of religious minorities. Unfortunately, that's still true in many parts of the world, less true in the United States, although there's a subtle form of discrimination, we would believe, against non-believers. But you're right, it's the practice of those beliefs. And One thing that especially concerns me, and something I'm addressing in a forthcoming book, is the fact that if we're to have a true democracy in which people can talk with each other and reason together, one clear prerequisite for that is that people have to be able to understand and evaluate and debate the reasons that people offer for their positions. And one can't do that if one side or another is relying solely on religious doctrine, because when that happens, you're obviously cutting out of conversation anyone who doesn't agree with that doctrine.
What do you say, Mr. Lindsay, to those who argue that, quote, this country was founded on Christian principles?
Well, that's just false. It's a mistake. It wasn't founded on Christian principles. We were the first secular nation, and that's set forth. The founding document is really our Constitution. Sometimes you get into debates with people who take the Christian nation viewpoint, and they'll point to the Mayflower Compact or whatever. Those really don't have relevance to the United States as a nation. Those are colonial documents. And when the people came together and decided to draft the supreme law of the land, which is what the Constitution is, they made an effort to take out of there any reference to religious beliefs or deities. In fact, the only reference to religious belief in the Constitution is one that says there will be no religious test for any public office under the United States. And, of course, to reinforce that, we have the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which says that Congress shall pass no law respecting an establishment of religion. So with respect to the vision that the founders had, they wanted to have a strict separation of church and state, which they thought, you know, there's been a lot of debate about the religious beliefs of the founders. To a large extent, personally, I find that somewhat irrelevant. And sometimes, you know, non-believers or atheists try to portray Jefferson or Madison or Washington as atheists. I don't think they were. I think they may not have been Orthodox Christians in all respects, but they were believers. But that, to me, strengthens the argument. It shows that religious people can support a separation of church and state. And they thought it wasn't just to benefit, you know, the government, but also to benefit the church. They didn't want government interfering with church affairs. And I think that's one reason you actually find that in the United States, there's more religious belief among the people than, let's say, there is in Europe. Because we have this tradition of the government staying out of church affairs, people are free to kind of explore their own beliefs. And you know, we have robust religious belief in the United States, at least compared to the European countries.
And yet, despite the separation of church and state in the Constitution, we have one nation under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. We have In God We Trust. We have most legislative bodies opening with prayer.
That's correct. And we would think the position of our organization is that those are violations of the separation of church and state. The one that bothers me particularly is actually the pledge. And unfortunately, just because of the political landscape, the composition of the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary in general, I think it's very unlikely that situation is going to change. To me, it's especially egregious because essentially it's a solemn affirmation of belief in God. I mean, the pledge is supposed to be taken seriously. You know, and I know sometimes it's ridiculed and people say kids don't even know the words they're saying, but in theory, it's supposed to be a solemn affirmation by school children. In many states, said every day. You know, it's required by law to be said every day. And part of that pledge right now, since 1954, is the affirmation that we are one nation under God. As I just mentioned, you know, it only came about in 1954. The pledge for the first 50, 60 years of its existence didn't have that phrase. It was added during the McCarthy era, during the era of the Red Scare. When the United States essentially saw the Soviet Union as an arch enemy, and because communists are atheist, or officially, you know, that's part of their ideology, the United States saw atheism as somehow being anti-American, which is...
And there are many people who still believe that.
Yes, there are. Unfortunately, there are many surveys that indicate that close to 40% of Americans would not vote for an atheist.
An avowed atheist,
even though that person was otherwise qualified for public office. And it's because of this distrust of atheists, that somehow atheists are viewed as immoral, You can't rely on them to do the right thing, whatever. And that's bound up, of course, with this cultural association between belief in God and morality, which, again, is unfortunate. I don't know if you want me to expand on that or not.
Well, yes, yeah. Because I think that's at the root of that poll that you cited, is that people would think someone who's atheist is at best amoral, if not immoral.
Right. It's unfortunate. And a couple things to say about that. First of all, it's kind of a confusion of things. It's undoubtedly true that for much of human history, including the history of the United States, the inculcation of moral beliefs or ethical beliefs was done, at least in part, by churches or temples or what have you. Other than your parents, it was typically your priest, minister, rabbi, imam, who would be the teacher of morals and ethics. So that's part of this. So there's this association formed between, you know, religious belief and morality. Nonetheless, there is no logical connection between the two. One can certainly, in terms of empirical facts, there's no evidence to indicate that atheists are worse people than theists. No better than theists. I certainly wouldn't claim that, you know, we're somehow a better character, but no worse. And that's proven by a number of studies that have been carried out by psychologists and sociologists. In terms of, you know, the reaction that people have in certain situations, and just by looking at our prison system, you know, if atheists were such bad individuals, presumably our prisons would be overflowing with atheists. Where in fact the reverse is true: the overwhelming majority of prisoners, both in federal and state prisons, are believers. They're theists of some sort. So empirically, that's false. And logically, it's simply not the case that you have to have a belief in God to accept ethical beliefs.
Your organization is most concerned, if I'm reading this correctly, about the influence religion has on public policy.
That is certainly one of our main concerns. I mean, we have in our mission statement, we go on to say we have three principal objectives, at least in the short to midterm. One is to reduce discrimination against non-believers. One is to eliminate what we see as the privileged position of religion in society. But the third one, which we think is very important, is the elimination of religious influence on public policy.
Give an example.
The debate over abortion, debate over same-sex marriage. I think it's pretty clear, especially same-sex marriage, if you try to look at that in purely secular terms and try to figure out, well, gee, would allowing same-sex marriage somehow undercut the institution of marriage? Is there some sort of empirical evidence that same-sex couples are less stable or would need divorce at a higher rate or wouldn't be good parents, what have you? There's really no empirical evidence against same-sex marriage. So the only argument against it really is, and it's shown by, you know, the attitude that people have and arguments that people make, is a religious one, that according to some religious doctrines, first of all, homosexual conduct is regarded as immoral in some sense. So to recognize a same-sex union would be essentially to acknowledge that, you know, this immoral conduct is acceptable. So that's one clear example. I think it's also very prevalent in the abortion debate. Well, there are sometimes you do get secular arguments against abortion, but for the most part, it's religious-based arguments. Assisted suicide or physician-assisted dying is another area where religious belief plays a predominant role. Again, you can have some secular arguments against the legalization of assisted dying, but most of the opposition is driven by religious beliefs.
There are some on the religious right now that are making a big deal out of the fact that if there is something like a gay rights ordinance passed, that their religious beliefs would be infringed upon because they would be, under that ordinance, required, if they owned a private business, for example, to offer services to gay couples, and that goes against their religious beliefs, so they feel like that ordinance is discriminatory.
Right.
That's a new argument being made quite a bit.
Being made quite a bit. It obviously, there was that law that was passed in Arizona, then vetoed by Governor Brewer, which would have allowed businesses to turn away gay customers, what have you.
Based on religious beliefs.
Based on religious beliefs. We think that would set a dangerous precedent. And our position is this: if you're going to enter into the commercial sphere, if you're going to decide to operate a business, and especially a business that's classified as a public accommodation, some businesses aren't. For example, if you have a billboard, there's no requirement necessarily to put up a particular message, right? That's regarded as kind of your private space. But if you're running a restaurant, a bake store or whatever, something that's regarded as offering services to the public in general, you have to offer it to everyone. That's part of going into the business. So if you feel so strongly that you cannot serve certain people, then your option really is not to go into business. Because, you know, if you take that argument to logical conclusion, this is actually a replay of arguments that were made in the 1960s when the Civil Rights Act was passed. There were some businesses that claimed it was against their religion to serve integrated customers. You know, they wanted to have segregation in their businesses. They thought that was important. Biblical passages were cited in support of that belief. But the government decided, look, this is, we have a compelling interest in making sure that people are treated with equal dignity regardless of their race. And nowadays, the government, most governments, state governments, also take the view that there's a compelling government interest in making sure that everyone is treated equally regardless of their sexual orientation. So it's not an infringement on religious liberty.
You mentioned earlier that there is a stigma against atheists in this country, and that stigma exists quite a bit today, don't you think? There are many people who are non-believers who would be reluctant to say that in public.
Yes, that's part of the problem. And it's one thing that we try to do, along with other secular organizations, is encourage people to come out. It may not be possible depending on your situation. You may be, for example, in an area of the country where the stigma is especially strong. It may affect you in your business. And, I mean, we know ourselves. We get letters all the time from people talking about how difficult it would be for them to come out. But the more people that come out—
Come out as atheists, right.
But, you know, it's actually similar to what happened with the gay and lesbian movement. I think one reason the gay and lesbian movement has made such progress in the last few decades, more and more people are willing to come out, and people realize, oh, you know, my friend— my nephew, my work colleague, they're gay and they're great people, you know. So a lot of the prejudice against people is based on really just ignorance, lack of knowledge. Many people probably have atheists as relatives and friends and work colleagues, and they're not even aware of it. And they probably think, well, these, you know, this is a nice guy, what have you. But because the people haven't come out, they still have, you know, this idea that somehow atheists are strange or alien and un-American, right.
Well, I have been speaking with Ron Lindsay, who is the president and CEO of the Center for Inquiry based in Washington, D.C. and suburban Buffalo, New York. And his new book is called The Necessity of Secularism. Mr. Lindsay, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Ronald Lindsay will give a free public talk tonight at 7 o'clock at the Missoula Public Library. He will also speak tomorrow night at 7 at the Museum at Central School in Kalispell.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with lows in the mid-30s to lower 40s. Tomorrow, rain showers are likely with isolated thunderstorms and highs in the 60s. In central Montana tonight, it calls for mostly cloudy skies with lows in the 40s. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and highs 65 to 75 degrees. In southwest Montana tonight, it should be mostly cloudy with isolated rain and lows 35 to 45 degrees. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with rain showers through the day with some thunderstorms in the afternoon and highs 60 to 70 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
The controversy over how Governor Bullock went about nominating 5.1 million acres of federal land for treatment to reduce wildfire risks has dramatized a somewhat hidden part of the recently passed farm bill. Even though many Republicans and Democrats had to hold their noses at the smelly mix of pork barrel and destructive subsidies in that bill, neither party wanted to go into the upcoming congressional elections having failed to pass a farm bill. Given that it was a bipartisan must-pass bill. Members of Congress could tack all sorts of special interest ornaments onto the bill. It was one of those that got Governor Bullock crossways with some environmental groups in the state. The law called for each state governor to nominate federal forest lands that were an imminent risk to public health and safety and in immediate need for forest restoration, insect control, and hazardous fuel reduction activities. These supposed emergency activities are to be fast-tracked and approved with very limited environmental review. Working with a small group of hand-picked people, the governor nominated 5.1 million acres of Montana for such emergency treatment. Setting aside the question of how much of a public process should have been used before the governor made his call, there are serious questions about whether commercially logging forests is a way to make forests healthy, safe, and productive. As with the development of most public policy, crafting forest management policy involves dealing with a mix of strongly conflicting emotional commitments, as well as conflicting objectives and a very limited financial resource base for implementation. The result, as some wit put it in the past, is like making sausage. Watching that is almost enough to make you swear off eating sausage. What will be created in our forests from this provision of the Farm Bill may be equally distasteful. Let us begin with how these forest restoration projects will be funded. There is, of course, limited money in the hands of the Forest Service, and what they have is constantly being drained away to fight fires. The expedited forest safety treatments, mandated under the new law, will be paid for by harvesting commercially valuable logs. That is, the funding mechanism is commercial logging of the areas. That, of course, has cheered the Montana Wood Products Association, that has seen overall timber harvest on Montana Forest Service lands fall off dramatically since the 1990s. This would be fine if the trees that would be removed in a profit-oriented timber sale were the same trees that would be removed to reduce the flammability of the forest. It would also have to be true that the appropriate treatment of the site in terms of removing flammable material also contributed to the profitability of the sale. But that, of course, is not the case. The larger commercially valuable trees should be left because they are the least flammable, and the tight bundles of scraggly packed small trees that will light up like a torch have no commercial value at all. The brush and logging waste on the forest floor also have no commercial value either. Because of this, treating these areas may well increase the likelihood that they will burn, not decrease it. In addition, the effects of the treatment last only for a short time because opening up the forest encourages new growth of bushy and woody material, as well as tight clumps of new trees. These treated areas have to be repeatedly re-entered to take out what is 100% non-commercial woody biomass. Usually there's no money left over to fund that, so it just does not happen and the flammability of the forest rises again relatively quickly. This is not just guesswork or pessimistic brooding. One has to ask how these forest lands got into the condition they are in that led them to be labeled dangerous and in need of emergency treatment, free of normal environmental standards and land use plans. As forest researchers in Montana have pointed out, the flammable condition of our forests at mid and low elevations is primarily due to human activities in the past, including past logging that has left behind a more flammable landscape than had existed before it was logged. Also, cattle grazing contributes. It removes non-woody and less flammable ground cover and opens the forest floor to explosions of woody plants that burn hotter. Finally, forest suppression also contributes to forest flammability. That fire suppression aims to protect the economic production of the forest, that is, commercial timber harvest. So management of the forest for commercial purposes tends to increase the flammability of the forest. Past logging not only did not reduce that flammability, but seriously aggravated it. Yet more of the same is now supposed to save us. That is as logical as the alcoholic's morning cure, a bit of the hair of the dog that bit you. This is not to say that there is nothing we can do to protect our homes and communities from wildfire. But starting off with a proposal to treat over 5 million acres is headed in the wrong direction, away from the problem areas immediately around our communities and homes. We should not be looking for landscape-wide solutions, which do not exist anyways and are so expensive they would immediately bust whatever budget we have. We should look at local safety measures where we actually live and the human-dominated landscapes we inhabit, not distant wildlands. That is both more effective in protecting people and property, and it is affordable. In addition, there are far fewer environmental problems since we would be focused on landscapes already committed to human use.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.